Sure, thank you, but I'm not that good. What a beautiful bunch of people. I know what the two words are on the front of this podium. And they're good. They're sort of AA. Let us do and let us listen. Isn't that good? That's those two words, Clancy. I had to work that out because I asked somebody what they said, those two words, and they said, "Happy birthday, Clancy." I don't know about you people, but so far as I am concerned, this evening could never be. No chance for this evening ever to exist, because I knew our birthday man 24 years ago. And if there's ever one man that ever came to this society that didn't have a chance, he's the man. He didn't have any chance of getting sober, let alone the other things that have happened to him. I wouldn't have given him 5 cents for the whole man and everything that he ever was and ever will be. I wouldn't give you 5 cents for it. 24 years ago. And I have known him the last 24 years. And I don't think that I've ever known a man in our great society that has improved as much as he has. And has done more in 20 years than this guy has for us and for our society, really. And I'm delighted to be here to tell you on his 24th birthday that I love him very much and I love his family. I even like his pony. Pony is about as ornery looking as he is. But he's a fine pony. Got a good disposition. I like his three-legged dog. You know. You got three dogs, and one of them is three-legged. Have you got any more dogs now? No. But this fellowship sort of has a habit of rubbing off on people that stay with it and do a few things. I was interested in our second speaker, who said that, I believe it was the second, that she went to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said to her, after he had discovered that he wasn't making any headway, he says, "You go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober. And then come back here and we'll handle your other problem." Now, I have a little funny feeling about that. Because I think that if we get sober by doing what the book tells us to do, we don't have any help for any other, we don't need any help for any other problem. Did you hurt me? Practice these principles in all of our affairs. It says someplace. Now, I am personally opposed to the thinking amongst many of our experts in the field of alcoholism that drinking alcohol causes alcoholism. Strange thing to me, because the man that started the program, the naval program at Terminal Island, that changed the entire stance of the United States military. The man that started that program down there will argue with me from now till Christmas that drinking alcohol causes alcoholism. And I know better, of course, because I drank alcohol and he didn't. That is, he didn't drink it like I did. He never became a pig. I drank it like a pig. And I know why. I think I know why. I think I drank alcohol because I was alcoholic. I don't think that I got to be alcoholic by drinking alcohol. And the problem never was alcohol, really. It was a living problem. A living problem. There's only one reason that I can think of that I'm not drunk right now. Just one reason. Not two, just one. I am not drunk right now because I have the thing I was looking for in the bottle when I took my first drink. What is the thing? It's the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with myself. And when I can live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with myself, I haven't the slightest difficulty living with you. Whoever you are, wherever you are, or what color you are, don't make any difference. The ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with myself is my definition of sobriety. And it comes with the doing of the things that our program suggests. You know, I get a real funny feeling sometimes with our people, because there's not many weeks go by that I don't get at least one call from somebody that has been 25 years around this program. And they say to me, "Chuck, how do you surrender?" And they've been here 25 years. And I fall out of my big chair. And you can't hardly do that because it's got sideboards on it. You know? How do you surrender? I can't understand. Because unless I read my book wrong, and I might, because I have the original manuscript. I have the original printing, the big red book. And I have most of the other printings right down till now. And sometimes I just about read them all in the same year, you know. Just to see the little differences. There are a few little differences in them. And, of course, the original manuscript says it pretty plain. It says, on your knees. Get down there at the side of the bed on your knees to do this fourth deal, you know. And so forth. They changed that a little. I like it better the way it is. Because I'm not so much a knee person. I'd rather lie down. But anywho, if I'm not entirely incorrect, before we get to chapter 5, our book says to us, if we be alcoholic, we've lost the battle. We're struck out. That we can't get an answer alone. That we have to have help. And the help has to come from a power greater than we are. Now, I think I'm quoting that thing right. If it's not in there, it should be. And I think it is. And when we get to the 12 steps, and it says something about rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path and goes ahead like that for a little while. And then it says, here are the steps we took, T-O-O-K, took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Took. Now, over the years, I have heard so many of our people also say, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't work for me. How many people have you heard say that? And that's true. Because Alcoholics Anonymous don't work for anybody. That's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way to do something. It's not doing something, it's a way to do something. And that's the reason it says in there, here are the steps we took. T-O-O-K took. They don't say here are the steps we heard read. And don't say here are the steps we interpreted. In the early days, which most of you don't remember, we had a guy out here in the valley that sold interpretations of the 12 steps. There was a lot of chatter about it for a while, but he quit selling them. You know why? He got drunky. Yes, he got awful drunk. And when you get drunk in a case like that, you lose your credibility. So he quit selling them. We don't interpret the steps. It's not because we know them by heart. I can give you all the steps right now, word for word. But that ain't it. It is tooking them. Here are the steps we took. Took. And when we take them, It is my opinion that we don't need a psychiatrist to straighten out the rest of our lives. Now, I'm not against psychiatrists. I just don't think I need one. Now, when we get through here, if any of you psychiatrists think I need to come, I'll check you out. Because I don't think I'm infallible or fallible or something. What does that word mean? But anyhow, it is my opinion that alcoholism is a living problem. And you and I have to have a living answer. And it's a matter of, totally a matter of an inside transaction. It's an inside job. And it could be read out something like this. We uncover, discover, and discard. This is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Uncover, discover, and discard. And it's all an inside job. Here are the steps we took. For instance, starting right out, step number one of the 12 says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable by us. Now, that is a twofold admission of defeat. I'm powerless over alcohol, physical, and I can't manage my own life, mental. So I've lost the battle twice over in step one. Now, that's a pretty fast start for now, isn't it? Lost the battle of life in step one. You don't have to wait till you get down to 12 or 13. Thirteen means that you come back to one and start over. But anyhow, a twofold admission of defeat. And they say, how do you surrender? We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable by us. Twofold admission retreat. Second is twice as bad as the first. Because it says there, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I submit to you that there's an implication here. Sane people don't need to be restored to sanity. If we need to be restored to sanity, we're insane. And that's step two. Step one, we've lost the battle of life. Step two, we're nuts. And step three is worse than both of them. Step three says we got to get out of the driver's seat. We got to get us a new driver. And I love this because I used to have a great deal of trouble with the people that rode in cars on the highways. It says police on them. They used to give me a lot of trouble. They'd pull me over to the side and say, get out of that car. And I'd say, it's my car. What are you talking about? This car's mine. Get out of it. No, it's mine. I own it. Get out. I says, I'll get out when you cut me out. And they take out their knives. And I get out. An alcoholic isn't a guy that would quickly make up his mind that he needed a new driver when he's driving. you know. We don't need a new driver. We drive. It's our car, isn't it? But that's not what they think. So, what are we talking about? Getting a new driver. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And as we understood Him, in my opinion, has nothing to do with understanding God. It has to do with the necessity of finding and operating with our very own God. Our very own God. And that's an inside job. That's an inside job. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Now, that's a new driver. And they say to me, how do you surrender? I can't believe it. You know. Now, our second speaker, or somebody, talking about getting fixed so we don't have to drink anymore and coming back and get our problems taken up, taken care of. How in the world are we going to not drink if we have the same problems that cause us to drink in the first place? You don't just go someplace and get your whiskey taken away from you and get sober. I think our bookie says, A, that we've been to human help. We've been to the doctor and the priest and the preacher. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. And B says that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C says that God can and will if we work with Him. Or if sought, according to the book. Now that's the reason we go to headquarters. Because people don't do it. And I think that this is one of the fallacies that our entire society has got to understand pretty soon about the rehabilitation programs. We got so many experts in the field of alcoholism now that it's surprising that we even come to these meetings, even classes meeting. Very surprising. Because we got so very many beautiful programs that fix us. We got so many of them that they're breaking the bank that pays oldsters like me. What's the word I'm trying to look for? Social Security. They're busting it all to hell. Because they all get written off. 8, 10, 15,000 bucks for, you know, 3 weeks to get fixed by the experts. And then they give that Social Security. And they're about to break us. And I'm in a bracket where I don't want to see it broken yet. So, knowledge won't do it. Knowledge won't do it. If we could have gotten sober and remained sober by knowledge, I wouldn't be here. I was probably the smartest alcoholic that ever got here until Clancy came. I never made it up to top of Mount Rushmore. He did. He's up there with the presidents on Mount Rushmore. How do I know? I put him there. That's what I did. At great expense. I want him to remember that, too. I never told him what it cost me, and I think I will. But anyhow, knowledge don't do it. Knowledge won't do it. I suspect that I knew as much about religion and philosophy as most people, the experts in it, knew before I ever got lost in alcoholism. I tried to get saved at 13 because in my family we were born sinners. Half my family was Hard Shell Baptist, the other half was Methodist Church South. And their treatment was that you got here struck out. You didn't have to get saved to go to heaven. You had to get saved to keep from going to hell. Because you got here lost. You'd struck out before you got here. You were born a sinner. And it scared me bad enough that at 13 I tried to get saved. And it didn't work. The preacher and I prayed like hell. And every once in a while he'd say hi to me, "How you doing?" And I'd say, "No good." So we'd start over. And he lasted until he wore out. And then he said to me, "Well, when you're baptized, it'll happen." So when the ice went out, I went in. And he ducked me. He brought me up and he says, "How you doing?" I says, "I'm all wet." But nothing else has happened. But he says, "When you're formally taken into the church, it'll happen." And I wasn't, it didn't. And for 30 years, I studied the religions and philosophies of the world, trying to find out how come I got gypped. And I didn't find out. I got very learned in religion and philosophy. Many of you have heard me say I could go into the bars and talk to the boys that were drinking in the bars. And I could do real well with them until I fell off the bar stool. And that's not good. You lose your credibility there, too. If you can't get back up on the bar stool. All I got out of that was a name. I got a soubrette. I was known as a drunken deacon for many years. But I didn't get sober and stay sober. I got drunker and drunker and drunker and drunker and drunker. Knowing everything intellectually that I knew. As a matter of fact, I can sit right now and look at me, and I can see that I intellectually had the answer to every problem that's necessary to my well-being. 50, 55 years ago. I believed everything that I believe now that's pertinent to my well-being intellectually, and had for 55 years, perhaps. But it didn't do me any good. Intellectual knowledge, until it's converted by action into wisdom, is a millstone around our necks. The more we know and the less we do about it, the more we have to suffer. And it isn't because somebody's got a big stick. It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. So, after 30 years of trying to find out how come I didn't get saved, I forgot about trying to get any help from God. I mean, totally, I decided that I was past that time. I couldn't even expect any help from God. So I put him on the shelf. And I had a nice little experience about that time. I started my last drunk on the Friday before Christmas, 1945. The Friday before Christmas, 1945, fell on the 21st day of December, 1945. I know because I've got a black sun in San Bernardino that looked it up and sent me the dope on it. He thinks he's my son, you know. I've got a son that'll do what he does. When I'm scheduled in a certain sections of Los Angeles, he comes from San Bernardino to meet me for dinner and drive my car into where we're going, and get out first and let me out of the car and take me into the meeting and bring me back and put me in the car and drive me away. And then we go over and get his car and he goes back to San Bernardino. Now that's a 150-mile round trip. And he'll do that every time I'm scheduled in certain areas of town. Now my plant, when I was in the business world, was right in that area. 4051 South Alameda. And I was all over that area in those days, night and day. And incidentally, drunk and sober. And I didn't have any problems. But he says, and the rest of them down there tell me, the times have changed. And he's afraid for me to go in there and afraid I won't get out. So he comes all the way. And he's the guy that found out what day was the Friday before Christmas, 1945. And it was the 21st day of December. So I had 10 more days in December. And I came to on the 18th of January, 1946. And the way I count that, that's 28 days. That's 4 weeks. And I don't remember anything that happened in that entire time. I don't remember anything. I don't remember the first drink, middle drink, last drink. I don't remember of getting my supply. I had to be mobile, because the family wouldn't bring me my whiskey for some reason or another. They just wouldn't bring it, so I had to go get it. And I had to drive my car. And I don't remember anything about it all, nothing. Mrs. C. sitting right down here, and she'd tell you if you asked her. That I destroyed 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days in that entire time. And I can't even argue with her, because I wasn't there. She was. So, I came to about the 18th day of January, and something had happened in my life. Every I want had burned out, and every excuse had burned out. For instance, I never made a mistake in the first 43 years of my life. Never. Because I always had some place to point the finger. It was your fault, my wife's fault, her mother's fault. Conditions and circumstances. The cockeyed civilization in which I was born, you know. It wasn't my fault, it was your fault. And I came to and I didn't have any place to point the finger. Because my excuses had all burned out too. And my first thinking after I came to was that for whatever time I had left, which was meager, because nobody could live under the circumstances that I was in at that time. I had to die, and I knew it. But I must rub out as much of the record as I could before I died. Because in all my drinking career, I never quit loving my wife and my kids. Even though I tried very hard on occasion to make myself believe when I was drinking that I didn't love them. Because loving them gave them the right to hurt me, and I thought I'd been hurt enough. So I tried to talk myself out of the fact that I loved them, but I never did. And I loved them the morning I came to. And my hope was that I could rub out as much of the record as possible before I kicked off, which was sort of imminent. And rubbing out a record you can't do when you're drinking. So I said to me, how am I going to not drink right now? And I didn't know how not to drink right now. I ran out of good drinking time before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. So, I didn't know how not to drink right now. And I had to know how not to drink right now. And the second miracle happened. The first miracle that morning was that I came to breathing. Now, I might as well come to dead, but I didn't. I was breathing. The second miracle was I remembered that Mrs. C. had found Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941 and had put it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now, hoping that when I came in, if I came in, I'd read it. And evidently I did, because that morning I remembered that I'd read that article. Never had thought of it for 5 years, but that morning I got it. And I remembered only 2 things about the article, that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And immediately, my little period of sanity was gone. I was sick to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the moment of commitment until right now, I have never had one conscious desire for a drink. Did you hear what I said? That's 36 years and 10 months ago. And I haven't had one conscious desire for a drink in all this time. And this is the great and significant meaning of this word, surrender, surrender, surrender. Surrender. And people say, how do you surrender? You know? Well, I don't recommend the way it happened to me. It was very effective because I died to self in that time. And I have never come back into that field of thinking. My wants were gone and my excuses were gone, and they're still gone. And I immediately said to me, look, I'm talking to me now. Look, son, we have taken your direction for 43 years. We've followed your advice. And it ain't been good. Look at it. We've lost in every department of life. We've lost a battle. A husband, father, businessman, man, and drunk. Taking your advice. So we're canning you. I'm talking to me. You know, we're canning you. And we're going to headquarters. That's where we're going. And that's what we did. Now I said to me again, because I knew these cliches, these things, these little sayings, I said, if it's true, fear not, little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. If that's true, it's a beautiful thing. It's a fine thing. Take no thought of tomorrow, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, or wherewithal you shall be clothed. If that's true, it's beautiful. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. I said, wouldn't that be great if it was true? Now, says I, how am I going to know whether it's true or not? And I'm still talking to me. And the answer came. You got to act like it and prove that it either is or isn't. And I started doing that 36 years and 10 months ago. And I've never changed it. I have never changed it. And life has gotten better. Month after month, year after year. For 36 years and 10 months. Now, I don't usually say this in a meeting because you don't have time to explain it. For instance, I was a very ambitious guy. I wanted very much in my early years, my first 43 years, to be successful, to get money, because I was born in a family that was too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. And I needed to get something. And I worked hard to get. And I ended up at 43 without two coppers to rub together. I always wanted to go someplace. Get out of the backwoods. And maybe run around the world a little bit. And as I often say, I couldn't even get to Watts. And my factory was in the curfew zone from Watts, and I couldn't even get to Watts. That's how far I got. And I wanted to be somebody in my own family, you know. So, when my I wants were gone and my excuses were gone, I forgot about going someplace and getting something. And I started helping God's kids do things they need to have done because I wanted to. I never quit it. And what happened? I got rich. Now, don't hit me up for a dollar because I don't give away. I'm rich and I'm going to stay rich. And you know something else? Since I quit going any place, I've been all over the world. All over the world that I wanted to go. I haven't been the Orient because I didn't want to. But now I think that maybe I want to go to the Orient. I don't know. But if I do, I'll go. And since I quit running my life, my wife's life, and my kids' life, we've become a family. Hear me? Now, this has not been difficult. This has not been difficult. This is the only easy life I have ever known, the only good life that has ever been mine in my entire lifetime. I hear so many of us say, this program is difficult. It's very hard. It's the only easy thing I ever saw. And the reason that it's easy is because I'm not going anyplace. I got nothing to win and nothing to prove. I'm not trying to get anything. I'm just doing these things. Now, the little cliches have proven themselves because all of these things have come to pass. And my life has been good. My life has been good. And it gets better. My only problem now is that sometimes I can't breathe. And I've got a wife that thinks I ought to breathe. Because sometimes I get up out of that chair of mine and fall on my face. She says, you got up too fast. You can't get up that fast. The oxygen leaves your brain. You got to get up slow. And she won't quit telling me that. Here about 2 months ago, I'd be goddamned if she wasn't going to leave me. Because I told her, shut up, I said. She says, I will shut up, and I'm leaving. Well, I didn't want that kind of reaction. I just wanted to get off my back. But I knew all the time that she was saying that because she loved me, you know. So it was my fault she was going to leave. She didn't, and I'm glad. What are we talking about? We're talking about this. We're talking about this. That when you and I get simple enough to go about our Father's business, and that's the only business we got, we discover that underneath are the everlasting arms. Now I'm going to go a minute or two over it. Because I want to tell you the fun I've had since I quit going to the business world. It's been about 12 or 15 years, I don't know how long. But I have used that time, a great deal of it, converting intellectual knowledge into conscious awareness. And it's come mainly from the other things that live around me down at Laguna Beach. For instance, I have some blue jays that I love very much, and we're very friendly. We talk to each other. And it's very nice. Now, I also have some hummingbirds. And they, I feed them too. I feed the blue jays, I feed the hummingbirds. And they're pretty friendly too. They'll even come and eat while I'm hanging up their food. You know. And we talk to each other and so forth. And I got some roses. I'm not going to do it. Turn off that red light. I'll quit when I get ready. Then it won't be long. So, I haven't yet found my blue jay looking at my hummingbird up there flying backwards and turning to his friend there and saying, look, look, that son of a bitch is flying backwards. I can't fly backwards. How come I can't fly backwards? So he gets up and tries it and falls on his, he falls. No, he's not even interested in a hummingbird flying backwards because he don't want to be a hummingbird. He wants to be a blue jay, and he knows how. Hear me? If I was a blue jay, I'd want to be a hummingbird. I got a bougainvillea sitting there looking right straight at the rose garden. And in 25 years, that bougainvillea hasn't decided to be a rose. He's perfectly happy to be a bougainvillea, and he knows how. And I've known forever that a salmon born at the headwaters of the Klamath River, when he gets so big, goes downstream, ends up in the Pacific Ocean. And before he goes back to the headwaters of the Klamath River, he's liable to have been to Japan and back. And that's 9,000 miles over there and 9,000 miles back. And he goes over there and back, and right back to the headwaters of the Klamath River to spawn and to die. I've known that a long time. And I said to myself, whose is his travel agent? Because you know what I do? I get lost on the freeway with a sign every 90 feet. He goes to Japan and back. So I have to conclude that God's idea of a salmon includes everything necessary for its complete livingness. Everything necessary for its life. The very idea of a salmon includes the whole deal. And he lives and moves and has his being in God. In the infinite intelligence that's all around him. We've got another little phenomenon down that I like very much. We're a bunch of swallows that show up at the mission down there on St. Joseph's Day. Every year of the world, almost on the minute, they show up. You know where they winter? In Venezuela. Who's their travel agent? God's idea of just a swallow includes everything necessary for its complete fulfillment, including going to Venezuela and back for winter. And here I get lost on the freeway. What am I saying? I'm saying that insofar as my experience goes to date, I believe that the only roadblock between me and you and me and my very own God is the human ego. I want or don't want, I like or don't like, I yi. The only roadblock there is. And that's the great significance of this thing called surrender in our program. Because it's got to go. Because it's divinely impossible to satisfy the human ego. Because it's duality. It's me against you, me against life, me against God. So, it's got to go. And when that's gone, life becomes so simple and easy and beautiful that we end up doing nothing but thanking God and passing the ammunition. And the finest formula that I've ever heard about, read about, or seen for bringing that about is our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got the finest formula I ever saw. And I know the book's backwards. And I further know that this is Clancy's birthday. And I've got to get the hell down here and let him have this thing a minute, because he's got to say something about us coming to his birthday party or something. I don't know what he's going to say. Maybe he won't even come up here. But I want to tell you this. I love the old fox. And I feel real good when I'm here and when I'm looking at him and when I'm listening to him. Traveling with him. I like to travel. He's a good man, McGee. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Chuck Bernard, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I've got a friend from Placentia, Keith Drum, and he knew I was a 10-minute speaker, and he said, if you don't tell the truth, I'll get up and yell phony. So, everything I say is the truth. I went to Clancy's little dinner tonight, and he had ribs. I got false teeth, and now my teeth are loose, you know, and I gotta sit here and clatter for 10 minutes. But, I drank alcoholically for 35 years, and I'm standing here tonight with 5 years and about 10 months, and it's taken me a long time to find this program. And I started in AA when I went to my first AA meeting. I was my early 20s, and I stayed at an AA rehabilitation house for about 2 weeks, and I knew instantaneously that I was an alcoholic, because I was a lot worse than some of the other people that were there. And right then and there, I made up my mind that that's the way I was going to die, as an alcoholic. And I pursued the rest of my life out there on the bricks till I came back this time. And I just sat in the bar, and somebody would come in and say, what do you do for a living? And I'd say, nothing. I'm a bum. I'm an alky. And that's the way I want it, you know. And it was a series of ups and downs. Every once in a while, I'd get ambitious. And I'd get out there and work for 6, 8, 10 months. And it's like Keith says, I would get up there 75% up the ladder and just walk away from it, you know. And there's a number of times in my life where I've been up there and I've had good jobs and good positions and just couldn't handle it. I just run away from the whole thing, you know. Walk away from a house, from a wife, from the kids, from everything. And find myself a place on a beach or anywhere that I didn't have any responsibilities, you know. I got married at an early age. I was 17, and my wife got pregnant right away. I wasn't married. I knocked her up, let's put it that way. I got married on a Saturday night, and Monday morning, my first kid was born. And I was a witness to the whole thing. We didn't have time to take him to the hospital. And I started working out of town. I'm trying to condense this a little bit. I started working out of town, and I found out that when I was away from my wife and the kids and the father-in-law and the mother-in-law, nobody bugged me and I could drink, and I stayed out of town. I would save my money, I wouldn't eat, and I'd go out every night and get drunk, and on continuously, and I was drunk on a job every day. I was in the glass business, and a few people got hurt because I was drunk every day, you know. But anyway, I was gone so long that when I'd come back, she was prone to getting pregnant very easily. And so she had three kids in the next 21 months after that. You know, she had them all premature, and I had a ready-made family. And she came to me and decided that we had to get out of town, and she made me take my first geographic. And I came out to California. And to show you how hard a time I had to manage money in those days, it was a long time ago, and in those days you could rent a two-bedroom house for about $80 a month. And I came out here, and I was I had a good job. I was getting $200 a week, and it took me 4 months to save the first $80 for that first month's rent, you know, so I could get her out here. And I finally got her out here, and my father-in-law died. My mother-in-law got hardening of the arteries. They had two young children. I took them in, and my mother-in-law, too. And I woke up one morning. I had a little house out in Reseda, and I had to go out and make my own breakfast table. I couldn't find a table big enough. And I looked over the table. I was 22 years old, and there was 13 of us there, and I was sole support, you know. But I got to tell you that when the old man died, I got a lot of money out of that. And I proceeded. She had hardening of the arteries, you see, of the brain. So she couldn't keep track of the bank account too well. So I handled it, and I promptly went through that in a hurry. It was somewhere around $50,000, and it took me about a year to get rid of it, you know. I bought two laundromats down on Pico, and I used to be there at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they'd get a straggler would come in and put a quarter in the machine, and it didn't hit the bottom yet. I had the key in the lock, taking the quarter out so I could get some wine, you know. So, needless to say, I got a divorce, and I wound up in a bar out in the valley, and an old Frenchman friend of mine said, what are you doing? You're not working. I said, I'm in between jobs. He says, you know anything about bartending? And I said, sure. And he says, I need a bartender. And he gave me the keys to the bar. And he says, take over the morning shift. And he gave me the keys to the kingdom, you know. And I had it made. And I was supposed to open a bar at 5:45. I was there 5:45. 5:45, I was plastered. And 2 weeks later, I lost my job. And it was on and on like that. They gave me a job in a parking lot, and I had to park cars for the bar, and it gave me two free drinks every night. Believe it or not, I kept that job for a whole year. I got shot at. They tried to drive the cars through me, everything else. But I made it for a whole year because of them 10 free drinks. And I lost that job. I found another job on Pico Boulevard, and I went to work in a bar over there. It was terrific. We even had our own doctor. Mary Ann calls him Dr. Feelgood. And he'd come in the morning and give you a shot of vitamin B12, whatever other kind of shots you needed. And you gave him a couple of free drinks, and then he'd take the prescriptions for all the boys for the day, and he'd write your name on it. It was all legal. You see, at 9 o'clock, somebody'd come back with all the prescriptions for the day. It was just great, you know. It was a heck of a life. I lived across the street, so I could keep my eye on the bar. I didn't want to, you know, anybody else take over my shift. Anyway, I stayed there for a year, and it finally got to me. My leg started swelling up. I started bleeding all over the place, and I finally wound up in a hospital. And all I could think of in the hospital, it wasn't that I was there because of my drinking. It was you know, I just wanted to get out. I didn't want to lose that job. It was everything I had in the world. And every day I was in that hospital, I was in there for about a week and a half, and all I could think about is I wonder who's behind the bar today. And I wonder if my boss is going to like him well enough to fire me and just take him, you know, and I just couldn't bear it anymore. And I kept telling the doctor, I got to get out, I got to get out. And finally, they let me go. I hit that bar, and 10 minutes later, I told him, I says, I want to take over my shift. And he says, God, take a week off. I said, no, I want to go to work. And I went to work behind the bar, and it didn't take me 5 or 10 minutes. I was back in the well and bleeding again and passed out on the floor. I just couldn't handle it, you know. Took a plane and flew back east and took another Geographic. And on. I came back here, and my last drunk was out in the valley. And it was desperation time, and my father-in-law called me. I was living in his little trailer. My wife had left me, and my second wife. And he said, I'm moving that trailer out in the morning, and I want you out of there. And I said, give me one more chance. And he took me to a Valley Circle Hospital out in the valley. And from there, I started sobering up. I went through detox, and I found somebody to talk to, good program. He got me interested, and I started going to meetings, and I stayed sober for a period of about a year and a half. And I was just going to hospital meetings, no other meetings, you know, and I'd stand there with the big book, and I'd look at the people over there with the Thorazine shuffle, and they'd ask me questions, and I'd answer it like I was, you know, an authority, and I'd never opened that big book. And they made me secretary of that meeting and treasurer, and I promptly left and took the whole $28 with me. And I just stayed away for 3-4 months. By that time, money had started coming in. When I was on the AA program, things went well. I got a little wealthy, money, property, and prestige. I got involved in some crooked deals and everything else. And finally, I was introduced to the Pacific Group, and it took me 3 years in this group of hiding in the back rows and not shaking any hands. And I used to hear Clancy up here and say, if you feel that you're not a part of, why don't you come up front and join us? Start shaking hands, and it just kept going over my head. And finally, I took the man's advice, and I started getting active, and it opened new doors for me. I sponsor a few people. They helped me stay sober. And my time is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Chuck. Our second 10-minute speaker is Carol M.
Hi, my name is Carol Morris. I'm an alcoholic. And I am scared to death. Your secretary is very cruel. I walked in, and he asked me to be the second 10-minute speaker, and I said, oh, Vince. You know, he says, knock off that shit, Carol. He said, you've been sober a long time. He just got back from Notre Dame. We just happened to be back there for a football game at the same time, so I don't know. Give it the old Notre Dame try, I guess. But I used to drink. I did not drink successfully. Obviously, that's why I'm here. But I grew up in West Virginia, and I was born into a family of very religious but very loving people. And there were 6 children, and I was different. No one else has the problem in my family, as far as I know. But even as a child, I knew I was different. I just knew. And all the things that they didn't want me to do, I wanted to do. And I made my escape to California when I think I was 21. It was a long time ago. By this time, I had been married, divorced, and had a 2-year-old son. And Here I am in California. I'm completely unskilled, untrained, undereducated. I have a child to support, and I have to make a living. And so I started drinking. I couldn't even do that successfully. Every time I drank, I became very ill. Alcohol was really like a toxic to me. I had a couple of drinks, I threw up, and that was the end of it. I couldn't even do that. And then I discovered diet pills and amphetamines, I suppose they're called. But that made everything even out with me. So I drank successfully for a few years until I really got into trouble with my drinking. Now, in the meantime, you know, during this time I was married, divorced, you know, I would be married and I would think, this is not quite it. And then I would be divorced and I think, this isn't it either. And this kept on for a few years. And finally, my drinking was just getting really bad. And my suicide attempts were about killing me. And really boring the hell out of everybody else around me. And I was convinced by my family that I should see a psychiatrist. And I started going to shrink in Beverly Hills. And I didn't know. I mean, I've learned so many things in this program. I didn't know that you're supposed to lie to your psychiatrist that, well, you really don't drink that much. I mean, he would ask me these questions, and I would answer, you know. And finally, after 4 months, he told me, to the best of his knowledge, I was an alcoholic, and he suggested I go to AA. He said, they can do something I can't do. They can help you stop drinking, then we can work with your other problems. So I really didn't want to do that. That's why I don't think anybody's motivation in coming here is important. I really don't. I went to please my doctor. That is the only reason, because everything had been happening in my life, and I really, honest to God, didn't know that any of my problems were related to drinking. I try to think today that some of the worst experiences with alcohol and pills, and to be completely ignorant of the disease is unbelievable to me now in retrospect. You know, at one point I was living in the desert and very serious suicide attempt. I mean, I ended up in the hospital. I had a very nice husband. I had nice children. And I end up suiciding, and my boyfriend and my husband and my four-year-old take me, you know, to the hospital. And I mean, I was dead. They did not expect me to live. I mean, and it was not just, you know, halfway attempt. But all I'm trying to say is things were really that bad, and I did not know that I had a problem with alcohol or pills. I really didn't know. And I came back to Los Angeles, and the drinking got worse. I mean, I still didn't know I had a drinking problem. One night I had two accidents in one night. And I mean, the first time out that evening I hit a tree, and sat in the car for a while and got up and started going, and continued to drink through the evening. And by the end of the evening, on the way home, I had hit another car, turned it upside down. The people were climbing out the side, which had ended up on top. And how I ever talked myself out of not... I think they sent me a ticket a month later that had run a stop sign. I mean, and, you know, I was just so lucky. I mean, I cannot believe, you know, I cannot believe that it didn't get my attention, and it really didn't. The only thing that got my attention was someone, the doctor, telling me to go to AA. They can help you stop drinking. And that's what I did. I came to these meetings, and I made an appearance, and I was like I was coming to a lecture. I mean, I read all the literature. I took notes. You know, went back to the doctor and reported about the meeting. I said, they're nice people, but they're nervous wrecks. I said, they just sit around and drink coffee all the time, and they just smoke all the cigarettes. And I said, they even smoke in church. And I just didn't think it was for me. But I kept coming back, and that's why I know today, if anybody's new and you don't think you're an alcoholic, it doesn't matter. If you've been getting in trouble because of drinking, you're in the right place. And I did come back, and I came to the meeting. I would go home, and I would drink, and I would think about it. And I spent months doing this until one day, I guess, or one evening, I heard the speaker I identified with, and I really knew that I was an alcoholic, and I knew if I wanted to clean up my act, this is where I belonged. And I've been sober now 13 and a half years. I would have had 15 and a half years, but I continue to take pills on the program. And that, to me, is the same as drinking. I know I asked somebody in the beginning, I said, is it okay to take pills? And they said, no, if you take pills on this program, you'll never make it. So I didn't ask anybody else. And, you know, I came here to stop drinking, you know, right? That's why I was sent here. But it's true. You probably will not make it on this program if you take pills. But I was at the dinner tonight that the first speaker was referring to, and I'm so important I got to serve the water. And but you know, it was honestly an honor to be with my sponsor and his wife and my sponsors and his wife, and it was just a wonderful evening. This is where I grew up in AA. It is in the Los Angeles area, and I live in La Jolla now, and the meetings are different there. And at first I thought, no, this won't do. They're not doing it the way they're supposed to do it. And I rebelled a little bit, and I thought it over, and I thought, no, this is where I live. I am an alcoholic. If I don't want to drink anymore, I have to go to meetings, whether I like the meetings or not. And I did go to meetings, and I'm very happy in AA there today. My personal feeling is you have to make it where you live, and AA is all over. We've lived in different places since I've been sober, and, you know, it's okay. You just have to, you know, I don't know if anybody's planning on moving or anything, but if you are, don't be afraid. We've lived even in Philadelphia, and I stayed sober, and, you know, it's really okay, but I just want to talk a little bit about my life today. I've never been happier in my life. I'm certainly not well. I married a man on this program with six children, and I had two, and it's been a lot of fun trying to keep everybody together. My oldest son is 28. Some of you know he just had a year on the program, and it's just great. I can't tell you. This boy was just like I was, only I think worse. Of course, in the meantime, I was going to Al-Anon and trying to keep my mouth shut and trying to let him do what he had to do to get to AA and to be where he is today. But I have a nice husband today. He's an egomaniac, and but you know, really, he's sober less time than I, and sometimes I think he's really growing more than I am on this program. I mean, I can't tell you, we have such a good life today. Out of the eight children, I mean, everybody's okay, and to me, that's what it's all about. I mean, my marriage is good. My children are in good shape. I have cleaned up my act in AA. And to me, if I'm going to come here and try to live by the program and try to be honest and try to live, quote, the good life, then I might as well drink. That happens to be my personal feeling. But I try to be honest today. I try always not to drink and not to take a pill today, but I try to live the good life today and be a good example for my children today, and it's good. And I would like to thank Clancy for being my sponsor all these years. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Around here, we define a birthday as 365 consecutive days free from alcohol, pills, marijuana, or any mind-affecting chemical whatsoever. And if you have such a birthday and you'd like to celebrate it with us, please see me when you come in, and we'll be glad to have a birthday cake here for you and celebrate your birthday with us. Tonight, we have a few birthdays. Our first birthday is for 2 years for Dolores S.
Hi, my name's Dolores, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Clancy for giving me the cake and for his guidance and his support throughout this whole year, and also for the structure of the group, which I really need desperately. And I'd also like to thank my friends here in this group for their help and their support and their love this whole year, and all of you for being here. Thank you very much.
Birthday is for 13 years for Nils L.
My name is Nils. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank God for bringing me back to life. And as Chuck said, we don't do it by ourselves. I'd like to thank my wife for her unfaltering love while I was stumbling. I'd like to thank Clancy for the guidance that he gave me, and especially in the first year when I was sort of a half zombie part of the time. I'd like to thank the other members of the Pacific group who were here when I got here, Clint, Keith, and all the rest of you. And just like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous and everything it's meant to me. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Nils. Our next birthday is for 24 years for Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Someone mentioned to me earlier this evening something to the effect of, I guess, your birthday's kind of special. It's different than the other people's. And after agreeing, I said there's a simple way you could have a special birthday. You found a group and then go to it every week for 19 years. And you'll have a special birthday too. But a lot of people don't want to go through all that bother. It really isn't much, one little juice a year for all that crap for the rest of the year. But I would like to thank my sponsor for giving me my cake and taking up an awful lot of time of my time. And there's no one I'd rather listen to. I want to thank my first sponsor, who taught me that you have to do certain things to stay sober, and I did them and I stayed sober, and he stopped doing them and he got drunk and died, and it was a great lesson to me. I want to thank a great many people who tried to help me when I slip. I don't often do this, but I want to thank Bob in El Paso and Fred in Beloit and Dr. John in Dallas, and on, a great number of people who were my sponsors and who gave up on me and said, we love you, but there's just nothing can be done for you. Les Ross, the man who I was able to hustle to get out of the Texas Insane Asylum when I should have stayed there, and on. When Chuck talked tonight about how rotten I was, whenever you talk about how you are when you're new, and you hear it so often from your own lips, it loses its importance. But when he was talking, I was remembering that 24 years ago, I couldn't find anybody who thought I would make it, me or anybody else. And the only purpose of saying that is that I know there must be people here who are, as I've often felt, weak and heavy laden as they used to say when I was a little boy in church, and feel, but you don't understand, my case is different. I have these other problems and additional things, and I have these sensitivities and anxieties and lonelinesses of the soul. And I want to convince you, I want to try to tell you at least, that these are indigenous to people like you and me. That isn't what makes you different. That's what makes you belong here, but it takes a while to find that out. I am most grateful that some of my friends have come here from out of town tonight to be here. It's not necessary, but I'm pleased. I'm especially pleased that my friend Ramon P. has stopped flaking off in the hospital for a few hours and got out here to look at me funny. I want to thank my family who have given me something to stay sober for, and other times given me something not to stay sober for. I'm giving him one last chance. I don't want to take too long. This is the last statement I'm going to make. I am most grateful. Sometimes I'm grateful and sometimes I'm grateful today. I stood this morning on Skid Row, where I stood 24 years ago, and I watched men huddled, trying to huddle out of the rain and the cold and the desperation, and look at their eyes just full of horror and despair and know there's nothing can be done for them. And it's impossible to think that 24 years ago I stood in the rain and huddled and my eyes full of horror and there was nothing anyone in the world could do for me. That's why I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been my only therapy since 1958, and for a God that helped me before I believed in him, and for the kindness and warmth of a great many people in this room and other rooms like this, and for the people who I sometimes think they impose on me by telling me their problems. I want to tell you something. When I'm thinking about your tedious BS, I'm not thinking about my tedious BS. And it's just like a letter from home with a check in it. And I thank you all very much, and I hope we'll all be here next year. Thank you.